From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the remarkable story of an effort to make CTs and MRIs less scary for children and yield better results. Later, why keeping marinas clean matters.
When people come out and enjoy them, the next step really is to protecting them so future generations can enjoy them. So if you can get the word out through boaters and people that are using the resources, it's a really effective way through tourism and marinas.
And was it inevitable, the idea of a water sommelier appearing tableside at a diner near you?
Just as wine could enhance your meal, the water could enhance your meal. And the water that you drink with wine could also be something that enhances each other.
Plus Minnesota writer Wendy Webb on the art of creeping us out. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Yesterday on the show, we heard about a collaboration being forged between Marquette University and the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design that's aimed at developing design and engineering simultaneously. The innovation on which Doug Dietz works is a reaction to what happens when function comes before form. Dietz works for Waukesha-based GE Healthcare, which makes imaging equipment like CT scanners. They do excellent diagnostic work. The trouble is they also frighten young patients, and that affects the kinds of results the machines produce. Dietz set out to do something about that, and he's here with a remarkable story of the result. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. What was the problem you set out to solve with this adventure series project?
Well, working at GE Healthcare, and we do a lot of kind of big diagnostic equipment. So it's big MRs and CTs. And actually, I call them shiny objects. So you have these big monster pieces of equipment. A lot of them, especially the MRI machines, can make a lot of noise and be very, very scary. And the experience of doing that, especially for children, can be traumatic. And then they have to sedate them, especially between 3 and 8 years old. They have to sedate the children probably 80% of the time so they hold still so that the scan looks good. So kind of the crux of the whole issue or the problem, or I guess you'd say reframe it to the opportunity, was why have we spent so much time just kind of almost like myopically thinking about the product itself and not taking it a couple of steps back and looking at the whole experience that, to be honest with you, the family is going through when they deal with the healthcare system. So that's really where it started, was seeing what can we do that to just make the family's journey through their healthcare experience better.
This is what some engineers would call fairly clinically the user interface. But really what we're talking about is how people have real live experiences with the technology around them.
Yeah. So I think like our group in global design, that I'm a member of the global design team, we do the industrial design. So the product design of what it looks like and the user interface design. And that part is of course very important for any product, whether it's a car or a piece of medical equipment. But boy, that experience you go through, maybe even before you even get into the room, is a huge part of how it's going to go through. So we were actually thinking about this. We call it the anxiety journey of from the very beginning that when you put your child in the car and you get to the hospital, all the way till when you see our equipment and your experience in the radiology department, till when you get home. So we tried to find solutions for these little anxiety points that the children go through when they go through this whole experience. Because it's crazy when you're trying to, especially if it's a child, in a lot of cases it has to go back to the hospital multiple times. And that's really tough. So they know when they're getting in the car, even if you tell them a little bit of a trick to get them going, but as soon as they see the hospital and they're following some blue line and going up, you know, 3 elevator to get to where they're going, they know what's going on, and then they'll see like a scanner that's making crazy noises or something, and the tears just start to come. And that's really where we wanted to focus with Adventure Series, of seeing how can we just totally change that whole environment. In fact, a lot of times we just describe it as, you know, what are 3 kitchen chairs and a blanket? And I mean, what are 3 kitchen chairs and a blanket?
They could be a fort.
They could be a castle. They could be a truck. They could be anything. And how long will your kids play with that? Forever. And that's where we said, oh, my gosh, because their imagination is so rich, and they just can come up with these ideas, and they can play with just these chairs and a blanket. I mean, I did too as a kid. And it's because you can take yourself to this special place. Well, why don't we, with Adventure Series, do that kind of thing and give them maybe a little bit more than three kitchen chairs and a blanket, and then allow them to take themselves and, to be honest with you, bring their family along with them to a special place so that when they go through the scan, actually it could be something that could be maybe even fun.
As fun as a CT or an MRI is likely to ever get.
Yeah, and I know, you know, for example, we really try to build the story around why would you lay on your back and hold still? Because for adults, if we go into a scan, we're like, okay, got it. You know, they're going to take a picture of the inside of me. But as a little one, you don't know. So like, for example, Cozy Camp, it looks, you know, the scanner looks like a huge tent, like a Eureka tent. And the table actually looks like a sleeping bag. So you lay on the sleeping bag and you go up and you go inside the tent. Well, the child totally understands that. In fact, sometimes they'll look over at the technologist and say, could you go in with me? And and, you know, the technology goes, no, no, you get to go in yourself, but if you need me. So actually we did on the wall, it actually looks like an old school kind of domed camper. And then through the window of the camper is where the technologist, because they need to leave the room and go in the other room to look into the, where the scanner is. So they just say, hey, no, I'm going to go in the camper. You get to go in the tent. And the kid goes, okay. And they got that. But that's a reason for them to lay still. So if you give them these elements of the story, they'll build on that. So whether it's, we have, you know, a pirate adventure, which is pretty cool. And it kind of has a part of the room that's got the shipwrecks that the little boys like, and then it goes into this beach kind of scene, which the girls like. So we kind of make it for everybody. So that's a pirate adventure is one. The nautical is one, which is the underwater where there's a submarine that the child lays on. It goes over a coral reef. That one's actually in the first one install that we did was actually in an ER, which was kind of crazy. So you think of this environment, this emergency room, which is just this hectic craziness. And in the middle of this is this really awesome nautical where it feels like you're underwater and you're taking the submarine ride over this coral reef. And it's just, you know, we call it tickling all the senses. So we have some aromatherapy that's in there. So in there we have a scent that's actually called clear water. So it has this kind of really nice kind of a water, I guess you'd say. And then it just takes a little bit of any of those little hospital smells out. And then we'll have, in that environment, for example, we'll have some music. I think they have like some harp or some music that your kids might be used to if they watch, you know, SpongeBob or something, you know, that kind of a thing. The lighting in that room is awesome. We have like an old school disco ball that's in the corner. And we just hit it with white light. And what's kind of neat about it is when, and it spins, rotates around, is when that little, it looks like a sphere, obviously, that it shines out. When it's close to the wall, it gets kind of small. And then, of course, on the wall that's really far away, it's bigger. And they just look like bubbles. So and, it totally and looks like it's in, you're, you know, underwater with bubbles.
And none of this interferes with the ability of the medical staff to be able to do its job.
No, it's pretty cool. And actually what they do, and actually in many cases, they've actually improved the amount of kids that they can get through. I think they're up like 7% as far as just the volume of patients. And to be honest with you, my hypothesis was that they were going to get less kids because they're going to want to play around. And we have cool characters. They're going to want to name them and hug them, which they do. But they actually are able to get them, they call it past the threshold, to get them up on the table and get ready for a scan quicker. So they're able to get more patients through. But you can imagine if that's your job every day to come into here and the technologists, they actually dress up in character, and then they just have this whole story going, and they're just, to be honest with you, they're just brilliant. I was in an MR the other day, and the MR looks like a spaceship, so that there's wings on the floor, and the whole system looks like the fuselage, and our characters are on the windows inside, so little kids will come through, and they'll see the characters on the inside. They go, okay, it's safe to go in there. The character's in there. Well, it's just a sticker on the side, but for a kid, no, the toucan or the hippo or whatever inside the spaceship with their space uniform on, so it's okay to go in. But the technologists will get into the kind of the story, and you'll hear them say in the MRs, they have that kind of sound where it goes, dun, 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 grrr. So all of a sudden you hear them say, hey, Bobby, we are about ready to go to turbo speed. So just hold still. You're doing awesome. And, you know, you'll hear the engines going a little bit faster, and then it goes from dun, 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 grrr. And then the kid comes out, and, you know, this is like a gazillion-ton machine, right? And the little boy, little girl come out, and they'll see their parents, and they'll say, did you see how fast I was going? Well, the technologists, you know, they use those kind of setups to help, obviously, the family, but the child have a good time, and allows the technologists, I think, to also just, you know, if that's where you got to go in to work every day, that could actually be kind of fun. So we have, especially in the pirate adventure, they dress up in their pirate uniforms. And so, those are some of the ones we have. We have Cozy Camp, which is a camping adventure. I think I talked a little bit about that. So there's a bunch of different ones.
Does it take a change in the way you think about things? I mean, your title is Innovation Architect, which is a term that I don't know that all of us are acquainted with. But does it take a certain mind shift on your part to be thinking, I'm working with medical devices, but I'm working to make them fun?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can tell you, most of my career was as a product designer, industrial designer, was working actually on the piece of equipment itself. And to actually take a couple steps back, I almost think of about it like a drop in the pond, is that the machine itself is just that first pebble that drops. But you got to look at those other ripples all the way out. And the richer you look at some of those, the better the experience is going to be with actually that first pebble, which is the piece of machinery. So yeah, it actually took some of my first visits to the hospital, especially the pediatric hospitals, to see these families struggling with getting through and it just being brutal, and even having some of my children going through some of the experience with just the whole healthcare system. So there was a big shift, and I'll have to be honest with you. When I looked at some of the things that I did in product design, whether that's designing a new CT or MR scanner, and then seeing these families going through the experience and struggling with that, is I really felt like I failed at my job. So if my job is to design this MR, I stopped at just doing the piece of machinery itself. And I didn't look at the experience because, to be honest with you, it was failing. If you have to sedate 80% of the time the children to get a scan, that's terrible. You know, that's just not what it should be. So, yeah, it was kind of a little bit life-changing. So, you know, back then I was probably called senior designer or something. So innovation architect is really looking at innovative ways to look at this, you know, reframe this problem into an opportunity and how to do that. And Adventure Series just happened to be one that we worked with the Betty Brin, Fern Shupek down at the Betty Brin Children's Museum here in Milwaukee. We worked with a lot of the child life specialists who work at the hospitals to help families get through, whether it's surgery or whatever. And I call them angels. I mean, they literally are angels. But worked with this kind of ensemble of characters to come together and help us develop this experience. I think our first brainstorming session was actually at a Bright Days daycare center right outside of our GE facility there, and working with the little kids and just seeing having them collaborate with us to come up with some of these ideas. We worked a lot with the kids advisory boards, like in Chicago. We worked with them, so it was probably 15 kids that we worked with, and we did sketches and we mocked up little scale rooms and came up and just, you know, did prototyping and pilots, iteration together with our customers to come up with these ideas. So to be honest with you, when you look at some of the success of some of these, it's hard to say who did that. And we look at and we just kind of look at each other and go, we did.
Do you think working on a project like this shapes how you will approach the next thing down the road?
I think it totally does. This has totally messed me up. So I just think that, you know, starting with empathy and figuring out where that is and letting the opportunities be derived from where that empathy source is totally changed how I think almost about anything. You know, where are you going to go on summer vacation? Start here. And working in a big company that our technology is just so cool, and where we come up with the technology and almost sometimes look backwards and saying, okay, now we got this neat thing, this neat technology. Where do we need to place it? And what can we do? And then ask the customers if they need it. This is flipping that whole thing around totally and going to our customers and saying, what are some of your issues? What are some of your problems? And talking with them and iterating with them to come up with some of these things. So, yeah, it's totally messed me up.
Did you have to twist any arms at GE Healthcare to get them behind the idea that you were going to design a CT to be like a pirate ship?
Oh, boy. Good question. Yeah, you know, the GE folks are awesome, but, you know, they're looking at, you know, quarter-to-quarter earnings like any great company would look, and they're looking at this. And this is, you know, looking at pediatric hospitals. I think there's 250 dedicated pediatric hospitals in North America. So that market's small. And looking at this, so that opportunity, the business case and some of that stuff that we're so good at, that wasn't compelling. So to be honest with you, I had to lean on the empathy part of it a lot more to get some of that through. But this actually ended up starting as a project that was self-funded. So it wasn't one that GE gave us a team of people and dollars to do this. We actually started working with a customer and came up with some of these ideas and actually put in our first three or four pilot rooms and then kind of started rolling it back into the big GE machine.
It seems like a remarkably simple and yet brilliant solution. Doug Dietz, thank you so much for giving us some insight into it.
Now you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me to come in.
Doug Dietz's title is Innovation Architect at Waukesha-based GE Healthcare. He developed the Adventure Series, a child-friendly design for imaging machines like CT and MRIs. You can see pictures of several designs from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The designs are in use in pediatric hospitals and units around the country, but so far not in Milwaukee. We'll learn what makes for a certifiably clean marina when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The month is slipping away, and probably only a few of us even realize that September holds the distinction of being Coastal Awareness Month to showcase the importance of the Great Lakes coasts to Wisconsin's history, economy, and environment. Todd Bribee is keenly aware of all of those things. He works with the Wisconsin Coastal Management Program. The agency recently awarded Reef Point and Racine and Milwaukee Yacht Club certified Wisconsin Clean Marina status. The two bring Wisconsin's count to 20 marinas that have gone above and beyond required and recommended environmental best practices. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz headed to the Milwaukee Yacht Club celebration, where she talked with marina manager Dan Couliard and Coastal Management's Todd Bribee. Bribee says his agency set up shop in 1978.
So 35 years, working with a variety of partners, including Wisconsin Marine Association, UWC Grant, Department of Natural Resources, and many other partners to develop the Wisconsin Clean Marina Program. And that has been ongoing since 2008, and our first clean marina was certified in 2010.
So what were some of the first programs back in the 70s that were taken on?
What the Wisconsin Coastal Management Program does is we're a state-federal partnership between the state of Wisconsin and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And the work that we are involved with is everything from promoting enhancing public access to Lake Michigan and Lake Superior and the coastal resources. We work with habitat. We work on water quality issues, sustainable economic development issues. And primarily those are much of what we've been doing for the past 35 years.
How do you decide from year to year where to put your primary focus?
One of the programs that we do, I think, is most seen by most people is we have a grant program where we pass through about $1.5 million on an annual basis to local governments, nonprofits, and universities for a variety of work. And we have a guiding council, a 14-member governor-appointed council that also sets policy direction with our program, and that sets the stage for the technical assistance and our grant program of the dollars that we pass through.
So, Dan, what does it take to become a clean marina?
It's been a gradual thing. I mean, I've been at the Yacht Club for almost 30 years, and it's been a step-by-step thing. Everything from the bottom paint on boats has gotten much less toxic. Rules and regulations have been put into place for safety and for water quality. Every year the standards get a little more rigid, which is great. And as long as we're moving in the right direction, we're eons ahead of where we were 30 years ago.
So give an example of a tangible difference from when you started to now. Common practice or the way the place looks?
Well, again, logistics. Boats need fuel, so basically there's a filling station right along the water where it's a very sensitive environment, and 30, 40 years ago, people would fill their boats and literally dump the excess gas in the lake. Boats that are manufactured now capture and reuse fuel so it doesn't go into the lake. The nozzles are different. There's all kinds of little things that are put into place to make it a perfectly clean. And even if you have a mistake and you accidentally put some in, we have contingency plans to remediate it right away.
So what can you do in that case?
We have special products that will absorb the gasoline right out of the water so it can be disposed of properly even if you do make a mistake like that. There's a lot of preventative and informational things for the boaters to learn, not only to learn how to operate a boat, but how to operate it in a clean and efficient manner.
In your own case, in your own awareness, have you always been mindful of what can we do in our lake surroundings to make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I think.
Be honest.
Absolutely. I'll answer that. You know, everybody, I think even the people that don't really deep down feel bad when they do something like pollute in any size, shape, or form, because when you sit down and think about it, you know, it's your environment. You're drinking the very water that you're polluting, literally. You know, a mile offshore is where the intakes are. So come on, you know, use your common sense. But everybody's really been good, moving in the right direction. And I again, just think that everywhere in the country, they should be as good as we are here.
So, got a paved parking lot to our north. Will that change over time?
No, there's a huge plan going on right now, and it'll go into effect next year or the year after the finalizations. There's three plans drawn up right now to take that asphalt parking lot completely out of there and put different types of bedrock and pavers and pebble and drain tiles, so that even the cars that park in the marina, if they drip gas or oil, it'll all go into filtration systems in the pipes and then be properly treated. Nothing will run off this parking lot and go into the lake. And they're going to put foliage and all kinds of extra islands where grass and green. And I do know a lot of the marina managers that are from smaller places up north that maybe don't have the resources to do what we do, but they're all trying very hard, and it doesn't take a lot to do the basic stuff. You can do 80% of perfect for not a lot of money. It's the last 20% that costs a lot, and that's what we're trying to strive to be, 100% an example here for everybody.
So once the system is in place, is it a costly annual system to maintain?
Not at all. It's self-proliferating. The better you do, once the big cost, of course, is like the parking lot and things like that. But once that's in place, it's just following the guidelines and the rules and the recycling and the watching what you're doing. Very little outlay once it's all in place. And you know, setting up the clean marina programs is wonderful, because once you've got the infrastructure in place, and all the members that come down here get a paper and says, you know, I don't know this, but hey, that sounds, this is what I should be doing for this and this and this and this and this. Then it's on an individual basis. You know, we can't be the policeman for everybody, but like I say, people in general, deep down, want to keep the place beautiful, and I think that's what we're going towards.
Can you give a little history of the yacht club here? It's an old, old club.
Oh, God, yeah, we've been here, not me, but we've been here. 1871 was when we were founded, and we were the first major club on the lake, Great Lakes. And we leased this entire area from the county for $1 a year for 100 years. And the reason they gave us such a fantastic arrangement was because we were to promote boating, promote and manage this lakefront. And it needed a structure and a club. When Milwaukee was first growing, there was no real municipal marina. It was the yacht club. And the marina grew from that. Again, it was...
You know, so you were the initial stewards?
Yeah, if you want to say that. And you know what? Yacht club, I mean, back in the day, you had to be of some means to have a yacht. And those were the people that started this and had this club and, you know, promoted it to everyone else to get into boating, which is beautiful. I mean, Milwaukee has one of the best lakefronts in the country. It really does.
So the two of you were you were discussing something with seemingly a lot of passion when I arrived. Were you singing the praises of your marina?
You know what, we were having kind of a deep conversation about civilization and you know, the right thing to do in society, and you know, a microcosm of that is the water and the lakefront, and it's part of, you know, our survival is reliant on the fresh water system, and that's what we are, you know, stewards of here. And sailboaters, for we were talking about the groups, there's splinter groups among the users in the boating community, and sailboaters always had a dislike for the power boaters and vice versa for various reasons, but especially because of the pollution factor. The sailboaters didn't like the fact that, and they were literally called stink pots, anything with a motor, you shouldn't have that on the water. And but that's changed now. The club was even polarized for years up until the early 1960s. The bar had a sailing section and a powerboat section, and you did not cross that line. There was people thrown in the lake that crossed that line. So,
isn't that interesting?
But now we're all one big happy family and really working towards one common goal, which is to keep everything clean and beautiful. So.
And follow up on what Dan said, I think the Wisconsin Clean Marine Program is a nice example of how multiple stakeholders can work together. You have the marine industry, you have marinas, you have local, state, and federal agencies working together to develop a program that's voluntary. It's for those marinas and those boaters that want to go above and beyond what's necessary. And so it's been a valuable program. It's built a strong stakeholder group, a strong partnership, and I think looking at the success of the Wisconsin Clean Marine Program, looking what Dan has been doing here for years at the Milwaukee Yacht Club, it's been great.
I think it's all about setting examples. It's, you know, everything, when you raise your kids, you set an example. When you're amongst your peers, you try to set an example, and that's what, you know, we try to do here. And moving in a positive direction is, if everybody does that and tries their best, it'll be a beautiful place.
Todd Bribey works with the Wisconsin Coastal Management Program. Dan Couillard manages Milwaukee Yacht Club's marina. They spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. The facility just attained certified status as a Clean Wisconsin Marina. Some restaurants in other parts of the country are going tip-free. Is that a good idea, and would it work in Milwaukee? Our dining contributor shares her thoughts when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Quickly, what is 17% of 55.50? Or maybe 20%? Unless you had a horrible meal, often the worst part of going out to eat is figuring out the tip, unless there are six or more of you, in which case the tip is often included. But some restaurants around the country are adopting a more European approach, and they're either building the cost of service into the cost of the food or just automatically adding a surcharge to the bill. The phenomenon is chronicled in a recent New York Times article, and that interested dining contributor Ann Christensen. She talked with Dan Harmon about whether she thinks it's a good idea for restaurants to go tip-free.
I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons to get rid of it, but one of the ones that I thought was kind of brought up as an example in these articles that we've been reading now, obviously Pete Wells, New York Times restaurant critic, weighing in on this topic, was just the angst that a diner feels as they're trying to add the tip to the bill. The angst. So to eliminate the angst, I don't feel any angst. So that would not be the reason. I think if, as we've kind of talked about, servers are making their hourly wage is so low that you can't make a living on that alone. You know, and they can't rely on people giving them tips. It just doesn't work that way, or giving them good tips. You can't even offer quote unquote great service and just assume that you're going to get a 20% tip or more, or 15, really, because diners make that choice. That being said, I think there are arguments to add the tip to the bill, you know, have it already part of that as an extra charge, I guess, or to raise the hourly wage of servers.
So the, if it's angst might be a bit strong for some diners, but it's still an annoyance, and it's not necessarily the best way to end the meal. I mean, of course, you know, getting a bill, who wants to get a bill? But then there is this kind of dance about, was the service good? How much do I
Absolutely.
Owe? Blah, blah, blah. So it might be nice to just walk away and knowing that they're compensated for what they just did.
Well, it's awkward. And when you're doing it and you see the server kind of lingering because maybe they're saying something like, you know, my shift is almost over. Do you mind if we settle the bill now? So they're trying, you know, you're trying to do this and they're kind of watching you, and you kind of know that they're watching you decide what kind of tip you're going to leave them, you know? So it's an awkward point of the meal. But, you know, Wells, one of the arguments that he raised was that because you're tipping at the end of the meal, it doesn't incentivize good service. Because it's at the end of the meal. If it's already included, if, let's say servers, you know, this is part of what they do every day. Their wage does not vary. Okay. It's a higher wage. Whatever they're getting is higher. It's not dependent on tips. So maybe they go into their job saying, you know what? I'm happy. This makes me a happier person. I can make a living. So this is what I'm going to do for every table that I serve. I'm going to give it the best service I can.
I mean, yeah, that presupposes that you do get better service if you tip more, which of course doesn't really, I mean, it's a prediction at this point because
it's a prediction. Exactly. Right. You don't know.
You don't know. So,
but he starts out that article, I'm sorry, but saying that if you want better service, in a restaurant, you need to be, number one, very famous. Number two, spend $1,000 or more on wine every time you go out, Or number three, keep going to the same restaurant over and over until you get the VIP treatment, provided that that were, right. would even be the case.
Well, the part of that argument that sort of bugs me is that good service should just be part of a restaurant's business. I mean, it shouldn't have anything to do with the tip. It should just be because they appreciate your business and that you're patronizing their business. And that should just be a given that no matter how much you spend, you're going to get good service. I mean, are they not shooting themselves in the foot if they're saying it's totally tip reliant?
Well, it should carry down from the owner to, you know, the bus staff, don't you think? Everybody on the staff should be part, feel like they're part of that team. And that nobody, you know, maybe, you know, everybody's part of it. And so therefore, you know, the servers really feel strongly about what they're doing. And yes, I am agreeing with what you're saying, but that's, you know, that doesn't happen. You know, you know that doesn't happen. And I talk to people about this because service in Milwaukee, too, especially, I think is generally poor. And restaurant owners will say, oh, it's really hard to find good servers. You know, sometimes it's, you know, they're younger, they're in school, and it's not something they want to do for a living. It's just something they're doing to pay the bills. So they don't. So in that respect, they don't really have an incentive. They just think of it as, you know, I'm just trying to make some money here, move on with my life. I don't have a passion for this. I mean, it's rare you're going to find a server that has a passion for serving, unless it's a really fine restaurant and they're really into it. They're into the concept, they're into the food, they're into everything, and they like people.
Sounds nice.
It does, doesn't it? It does. But you go to big cities, you go to New York and Chicago, and you've got people like that, I'm sure. You've got people probably that are making a living doing it,
yeah.
A good living.
Well, the other part of this, which is sort of a can of worms, is that if you are a reasonably well-informed diner, you know that the tip trickles down. It trickles down to various other employees in the business, and it just makes it seem a little odd to me in some ways. I've always thought it was odd that, you know, I'm tipping our server knowing that they're going to tip the bus person, the busser, maybe the people that are washing dishes. And it just seems
they divvy it up at the end of the day.
There's such pressure.
But is that across the board the way it works?
I don't know. You never know.
I don't know. I mean, I know there are restaurants where that is what they do. And then, yeah, you might feel like, well, listen, I wanted this, the one who really like broke their back. Well, not broke their back. Okay, fine. they really went above and beyond what might have seemed, you know, regular service. They really went out of their way to be, you know, a shining example of a server. I don't know. And so you feel as the diner, you really want to reward them for that. You don't want to reward the entire staff because you don't think they deserve it. So I guess that it does raise that question. I mean,
because I'm not a geopolitical labor expert who knows the ins and outs of who's getting what money for doing what task. I mean, I feel like diners are put on the spot sometimes through their tip to address these issues of pay, mm-hmm. and that's a lot to ask of someone that just wants dinner.
Yeah, well, it is interesting because it raises these things that in some ways you don't even really want to think about. But as we were we're talking about this. You think of bus boys or bus people. I don't want to genderize them. And they deserve something, right? Do you ever go to a restaurant and think, oh, I want this $10 to be specifically for that bus person? Nobody does that. And yet they deserve to be compensated. I don't know, you know, especially if they're doing the best. They're doing the best at what it is they're assigned to do, right? And a lot of them are kids that are 16. They're just... It's maybe their first job. They're just learning the ropes. And they're working hard. I mean.
Do you think any restaurants in Milwaukee are going to try it?
No. I don't. I just don't think that. I feel like, I mean, someone would really need to go out there and obviously set, you know, make the step and do it. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure that any one of them would do that. I don't know. I could be wrong, though. I mean, there's one place that I think of that perhaps would do it. I could see maybe Sanford doing something like that. I'm not saying they would, but that to me that would be the one I think of. But I just don't know. I mean, I feel like a lot of, you know, and when you get in more into the more middle-priced restaurants, I don't know. I just feel like that is just not something that would happen by and large here.
I think someone should try it.
I agree. I think it's worth the experiment. Yeah, absolutely.
See what happens. All right. Well, let's change subjects radically here. Something that's been getting a lot of attention lately is the water sommelier in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The water connoisseur. Tell us about that. Tell us, first of all, a little background on that.
I love this. Okay, so there's a restaurant in Los Angeles by the name of Reyes and Stark. And the GM is a German gentleman who is also a certified water sommelier. Now, most people have heard of wine sommeliers, but they haven't heard of water sommeliers. But he apparently has this training he's very much a connoisseur of water. And he will say that in Germany, there are 580, I believe he's being quoted as saying 580 different kinds of bottled water. And Europeans are generally very discriminating about water, whether it's still or sparkling. And I don't think that Americans have that same kind of discriminating taste for water. But I may be wrong, because I know people that'll say, oh, I don't like Evian, I really like Fiji, or vice versa, or, you know, that are very particular about the bottled water they will buy and drink. And I'm a big fan of sparkling.
And they'll be looked at sideways for saying it, but they
exactly.
might be onto something.
They might be onto something. But so, and when you think about the premise here, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. You know, water from different regions is going to have, you know, a different salt content, a different mineral content. So many of the environmental variables are going to affect the water, what the water is going to be like. And this guy is saying that the kind of water, the type of water that you drink is going to maybe, just as wine could enhance your meal, the water could enhance your meal. And the water that you drink with wine could also be something that enhances each other. So anyway, this guy, it's actually kind of an interesting thing. They have a menu. This particular restaurant, Reyes and Stark, has quite a few bottled waters from 10 different countries on their menu, and they have a water tasting menu as well.
For $12.
For $12.
Hey, that's not bad. If you consider paying $2 for a bottle of water, is not atypical.
Well, okay, when you think of beverages, though, that are really good for you, that are essential for the human body, what is that one beverage that you think of? It's not wine. It's
gin.
Not coffee. It's not gin. It is H2O. And why not give it the most attention, or give it the attention it deserves, and not just think, tap water. You know.
I mean, I agree. There are different tasting waters. I mean, you can get some foul-smelling sulfur kind of water and no one would touch it.
Right.
So why not the other end of that scale? Sure.
It's true. It's true. So I find this kind of fascinating. You know, I don't see this becoming a huge trend in the United States, but I could be wrong. Certainly doesn't hurt to offer a lot of different waters on your menu, I guess, and see how it goes if people are ordering it, or whether they're losing money on it. I don't know.
I can see some restaurants here advertising the Icelandic water and some of the other more exotic, quote-unquote, waters. And sure, I think people would go for it. No?
Yeah. I simply don't know. I'm kind of a water snob, though. I love sparkling waters. I love different types of bottled waters too. But this actually, I laughed when I read about this, because I thought this was pretty amusing.
I think you need to book a flight to LA and just go to this restaurant for the water.
I think I do. I think I need to book a flight to Germany and check out all those different varieties of waters. Yes, thank you.
All right. Ann Christensen, thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
Ann Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine and our regular dining contributor. She spoke with Dan Harmon. When was the last time you were really unsettled by a book? Wendy Webb's latest novel promises to send a chill up your spine, and we'll get some insight into just how she does it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. A well-crafted novel can immerse us in a place, make us relate to the characters, and even instill a feeling that carries us through to the last page. Minnesota writer Wendy Webb's latest book transports us to a scene that a lot of Wisconsinites might find familiar, the shores of Lake Superior. The fate of Mercy Albin also introduces us to a likable protagonist. Grace Albin returns to her childhood home and learns her family's past is lined with dark and disquieting secrets. By the end, we are pretty thoroughly creeped out, and that's actually a good thing. Wendy Webb joined us on a recent visit to Milwaukee. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
So maybe I'm assuming something I shouldn't with this question, but I would imagine that you write books that you yourself would like to read. So my question is, why do you like to be scared by a book?
You know, that's a really good question. And in fact, my friends think it's so funny that I write scary books because I'm such a wimp when it comes to scariness. I read The Shining back in the 80s. I'm still not over it. I am still scared by The Shining. So it kind of happened. I love ghost stories and I love things that go bump in the night. And it just sort of, I didn't set out to write a ghost story, but it just sort of happened that way.
Is there a distinction in your mind between the idea of being scared and being creeped out?
Yes. I don't like to be scared, and I don't want to scare my readers, but I just want to give them a little spine-tingling, goosebump feeling. But I really don't want to scare anybody. I'm not writing, about scary clowns in, sewers and
there's not gore and gross stuff either.
No, not a bit.
It's just if I had to – actually, I was describing this to somebody. I felt like as I read this, I was uneasy the entire time.
Oh, see, great. That's exactly what I'm going for. They call it gothic suspense, and I didn't even know there was such a genre when I started writing, but that's what they are, I guess.
The book is set on the shore of Lake Superior, mm-hmm. which also happens to be the place from which you write. Is place its own sort of character as you construct a story like this?
You know, I have found that I start with place, with either an area of the country or, more often than not, a big house. That sort of inspires me, and then the story just flows from there.
I don't know that I have anything in particular to support this feeling, but it seems like there's something more haunting about Lake Superior than maybe the other Great Lakes.
I think there is. I love Lake Michigan. I've been traveling a lot around Lake Michigan, love the little communities here. But Lake Superior just seems more fierce and foreboding and, for the people who live on it, almost alive.
And remote in a way. I mean,
yes.
You live in a large city on Lake Superior, but it's a large city that is very much distant from every place else.
It is. And the weather doesn't help matters.
So doing an interview on this book is a tricky exercise because the twists and turns start happening essentially on page one. But let's frame the story a bit. Where exactly are we and what sets things in motion?
I always tell people it is a mystery about long-buried family secrets that bubble to the surface one summer. And it starts when our heroine, Grace, goes home for the first time in about 20 years when her mother dies under questionable circumstances. So that's how we kind of slide into the story.
And she has she is part of the family secrets or has access to the family secrets, and she dies just as she's about to tell the story to a journalist.
That's right.
We follow the story through the eyes of Grace Albin, who, as you say, has just come back to Albin House after almost 20 years. Why was it important to the story for her to have been removed from Albin House for all that time?
I wanted her to have a sense of discovery. And if she was just going home to her parents' house where she'd been forever, there wouldn't have been that discovery and newness for Grace that there was for her being away. Okay, that was a little
right, exactly. But and as we say, it is tricky to because we really don't want to give that much away. That is the beauty to this.
Right.
How much are you surprising yourself when you write a story like this? And how much do you have to have already plotted out? You know, how many mileposts do you have that you're trying to meet as you write?
You know, I love that question because a lot of authors do very careful outlines, but I find that I don't. I tried to outline a book once and it felt then when I got to writing it, it felt like I was writing a term paper. So I do not outline. I go in with a general idea of the story I want to tell, and then I just write it as like my readers are reading it. So I'm surprised by things that happen, and I feel that my readers will be surprised too.
Does it make the writing process more challenging? Do you find yourself having to constantly go back to make sure that you don't have these, you know, errors in, you know, continuity errors, if you will?
All the time. I write myself into a corner all the time. So when I get to that point, I always tell people, you know, I don't really believe in writer's block. I can always sit down and write something, but it's plot that stops me sometimes. And I'll have to just, you know, close my computer and walk the dog and just kind of think it out.
There is a book within a book that plays out as the story goes on, and we learned that that book was inspired by the events that took place in Alban House's past. Was there anything in particular that inspired this story for you?
Yes. I wanted Grace to find out what happened at Alban House 50 years ago. And so just as a writer, I thought, well, how is she going to learn this? Well, her mother's dead. She can't tell her. Of course, the maid could give her some enlightenment. But in my first book, the maid told the story. And so I didn't want the maid telling the story again in my second book. And I thought, well, this guy's a writer. Let's have him write it.
There is a love interest that turns up for Grace, and he is actually a clergyman mm-hmm. that she meets. And what struck me about him is he seems like he is, for lack of a better term, the only kind of ray of lightness that shows up in this book.
You know, and the way that came about is kind of interesting, too. I wanted her to have a love interest because, you know, it's kind of a fun escape from a suspenseful plot. So, she can fall in love and whatever. And I thought, well, who's that going to be? It could be the lawyer. Who's she going to meet? And I thought, no, she's planning a funeral. Let's have her meet the minister. And what I did immediately when I thought of that is I called my former brother-in-law, who happens to be a Lutheran minister. And he sort of walked me through, because I didn't want to offend any people, and some pretty ugly things happen and otherworldly things. And I would go to Paul and I'd say, okay, so imagine this is happening to you. How would you react? And he gave me a lot of insight in that.
Well, and again, I think this is a little tricky because, as you say, otherworldly things happen, and there's not really a lot of reconciling of the paranormal with religion that goes on.
Right. And, you know, and again, I didn't really intend this, but my readers have told me that they really like the dichotomy between good and evil, that Matthew is a minister and he's kind of coming from the good side. And then there's another character in the book whose name I won't reveal that is pretty evil. And the readers really like that interplay.
I've read a number of interviews with people who write suspense, and they've talked about the challenge of credibly setting a scary story in the present when everyone is connected with cell phones and the internet. Mm-hmm. Was it a challenge for you to make the suspenseful scenes happen in a way that people would believe that, you know, it's not a, oh, my God, you know, another cell phone has died?
You know, and yes. The issue of technology, I really try to kind of leave that out so the story seems sort of timeless because, you know, I read a lot of books that were written maybe back in the 70s and they seem kind of dated now. And I hope that people will be reading my books for a long time to come. So I try to leave all that stuff as far away as I can.
And it also helps that that some of the suspense plays out 50 years before.
That's right. That's right.
You wrote on your blog about what it takes to put together an effective paranormal mystery. And one of the points that you make is about making the reader comfortable in a place and then pulling the rug out from under them. What are you getting at?
Not that I like to do that in my real life. The thing that really interests me when I'm reading a book is when I'm opening those pages, I want to go to that place. So I want the place to be kind of warm and inviting. But then, you know, some evil and some scary things creep in. And that's just real life. You know, things happen. I want the stories to seem like they're real life.
How did Grace Alban change in your mind between the time you started writing the story and what's in the pages that are sitting on the console in front of me?
When she enters the book, when we enter her life, I guess is a better way to say that, she's coming out of a divorce. She's a little bit annoyed at her daughter. She's angry that she's got to be home again and all these responsibilities. And through the course of the book, she grows to understand what it means to be the head of the Alban family. I think she finally grows up. She leaves her past behind and she grows up.
Was that character development a surprise to you?
It was. It was. And I started writing it but her voice was very clear in my mind. But then just through the things that had happened in the book, she really does grow. There's a nice arc there.
There is something it's interesting. I find myself comforted by whenever I read a scary story that's written in first person past tense. I know right away that the main character is not going to die.
Or do you?
Or at least I think that. Yes, that's it.
Well, and the interesting thing, this book ends, and I'm not going to give anything away, but there's a little scary epilogue at the end. And when I originally wrote the manuscript, it didn't have that in it. I had everything kind of tied up in a nice, neat bow. And my agent said, ooh, what if you put a scary ending on it? And so many readers have loved that ending.
It very much is a or do you
yeah.
kind of ending.
Yeah, exactly.
The end, or is it? You mentioned your real life, if you will. Does your work as a magazine editor overlap in any way with your fiction, or are you really exercising different muscles in these two worlds?
It was a problem for me because I'd been a journalist my whole career. And as a journalist, we tell stories. But as a novelist, people kept saying, you have to show it, don't tell it. And I thought, what the heck does that even mean? Why can't I say Grace is angry? Well, because it's boring to read. And so writing a novel is a completely different form of writing. And it took me a while to get it.
Well, I also wonder about the idea of, having to not worry about burying the lead, if you will, because you can't give everything away at the top or nobody will read the next 280 pages.
Exactly. I can't say in the first paragraph, well, here's what happens and now I'll tell you how.
More fun or just a different kind of fun?
It's a different kind of fun. I still love writing magazine articles. I'm still the editor of Duluth Superior Magazine, and I just love it. But you really get to stretch out when you're writing a novel, and you really get to know those characters. And, they sometimes start talking to you in the middle of the night, which is a little disconcerting given my characters.
do your magazine readers, do they do a double take when they read your fiction?
They love it, and they come out and support me, and I'm just really grateful for that.
Well, Wendy Webb, we're grateful that you were here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wendy Webb lives in Duluth. Her latest novel, set on the shores of Lake Superior, is The Fate of Mercy Alban, and she joined us on a recent swing through Milwaukee. Our interview first aired in August. That's Wednesday's edition of Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So glad to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. Thank you.